Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Alpharetta, Georgia, it's time for Alpharetta Business Radio, spotlighting the area's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome, everybody. This is your host, Chris Deekle. In station with us today, we have Patrick Clements with Big Web Apps and Sherpa Desk. That's a software application that helps businesses keep track of their projects, their billing, and their assets, and make sure their customers get served on time. We have a return engagement by a prominent law firm. In fact, it's probably the largest in North Georgia now, Hypes and Bell Isle. Karen Cation was on earlier and was so good I said, bring the whole team back. Because it's a powerhouse law firm here in Alpharetta, and it has two principals, David Bell Isle and John Hypes. They are the partners in this, and I think just looking at their resumes and Karen's, I think you probably have to graduate in about the top 1% of your class in law school or undergraduate to qualify for this firm. I mean, we have people that are magna cum laude and cum laude and, you know, graduated with high honors. I mean, this didn't sound like the part of the class I graduated from years ago. I think I'll borrow one of Jeff Foxworthy's lines and said, well, I graduated in the half that made the other half possible. So we're delighted to have David, John, and Karen with us. I'd like to start off with Patrick Clements and his firm, Big Web Apps Sherpa Desk. Patrick, tell us about Sherpa Desk, what this is, how it got started, and who it helps.
Thanks, Chris. I'm with the co-founder, Sherpa Desk, and we started off Big Web Apps about 2001, and we launched a web-based application to support local governments, school districts, and higher education to manage their customer requests, manage their assets, and projects that they had. Over the last 12, 13 years, we've actually grown and had a pretty decent footprint here in the state of Georgia. I think over 30 counties actually use our system on a daily basis, and we have about 100,000 logins daily nationwide. About 18 months ago, we repurposed it, and we wanted to get more into the small business market, so we created a new product called Sherpa Desk, and it's really focused towards small, medium-sized businesses that provide personal services that want to track an easy way to track customer support issues, track project, and track time and billing issues. From there, we can allow these small businesses to engage with their customers from pretty much anywhere, mobile platform, online, as well as over the phone.
So, from your customer standpoint, what problems does your software solve?
Well, it solves the number one problem is if I am a small business and I need to engage with my customers, I need a way for them to contact me. So what we do is we allow you to create a portal, and you can expose content, articles, and integrates into social media such as Twitter and Facebook. But it allows you to expose information to your end users, as well as it gives them a way to contact you. And we integrate into your email system. We're in with Google, the Google Marketplace, as well as allow them to just go to your website and submit issues. So what we're trying to do is allow you to easily and proactively respond and service your customers more effectively. And then on the back end, you can start reporting on some of your, you know, your performance metrics is how well you're doing, how well we're performing, how fast are we responding. And because nowadays everybody understands that it's much easier to retain a customer than it is to get a customer. And so what we're trying to help these small businesses do is stay in front of that support cycle.
So how have they tried to do it before?
Still traditionally what it is somebody sets up a business and they send an email. Hey, I got a problem. Or they'll pick up the phone and call. The problem is that is you lose visibility on what you're tracking, what type of support issues, and you don't know, if I go in there and support, there's a router fix. A big part of our customers is IT support people. And so they go and fix a router issue. Well, they've lost that visibility because it's come in an email and there's nothing to track it. You can't run analytics. You can't see how you support it, and maybe 3 months down the road that router fails again. There's no visibility with their email. So what we try to do is try to take existing practices that you're doing, such as email, and then incorporate it into our system. So if you send an email, it's actually going to create a ticket. Or if you send in or you create a phone call, then we can actually, if you're tied into a voice over IP system, then we can actually create a ticket. And so once you have a ticket, you have a content record, and you can run data on it.
From the reverse side, from the business's point of view, what does it help them track in terms of performance metrics of their people and, you know, repeat visits for the same problem, things like that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The number one, 96% of the reason that most customers get frustrated is the lack of response, is being able to send a message out into the web sphere and not being able to get any kind of feedback because they have a problem and they need attention, like, right then. So what we do is we can actually track the response rate. It's like, how fast are we responding to our customers? Then you can also, post-fact, once the resolution is resolved, you can start tracking through surveys, how well did we resolve that issue? So you can start measuring that satisfaction level. So that's the response and satisfaction are really like the two main things that we're doing. And then from a customer engagement standpoint, but then from a back end, we can help manage projects. So if you're, again, I'll use the IT support guys that have projects and they need to be able to measure, you know, how much of the project's been done, how much is it close to being completed. And from a management standpoint, I can get visibility over like all my projects and then how much is left in time and billing that needs to be done.
So can you set up benchmarks that the service people are shooting to meet?
That's it. We call it SLAs. So it's their service level agreements. And what you try to do is for level one priorities problem, we want to respond in 15 minutes, and we want to have a resolution within, you know, 2 hours. That's just a typical SLA. And then we want to try to meet that goal 85% of the time. Well, now that you have these metrics in place, once these issues start coming in, you can start seeing how we're meeting those expectations. Either one is we're doing well and we can, you know, keep motoring along, or you know, after 3 months we can reevaluate and says, is this unrealistic expectations that we're putting on ourselves? Is our customers you know, happy? Are they returning customers? Are we reducing the amount of repeat type of issues?
An interesting model certainly helps almost anybody that has a customer service function.
That's exactly right. Yes, anybody that's engaging with customers and looking to try to reduce the amount of support that is coming in.
I was looking at your website, and you have a pretty interesting model. It's not, it's kind of unbundled, and you can buy what you need.
That's one of our things that we call like the secret sauce. We feel like a lot of the industry is starting to move towards total pay for what you use, utility based model, and we don't want to force you into buying siloed packages and taking on bloatware that you just don't need. Just because I want to get this particular feature, I've got to pay at this certain price point. So what we do is we've broken down our solution into being totally utility-based. And so what we want to do is we want to be able to grow with the company, and we also want to contract with the company so that you're not pigeonholed into like a certain price point. And then the a part of our marketing is the entry point is free. So there's some small amount of usage of the application that you can just use for free. If you're just a single one-man shop and you just need a way to support your customers, you can use our application for free. We're hoping as, you know, you grow your business, then we grow with you.
And if you're a fairly small shop, I mean, the price point didn't look like you would spend a lot of money to have, you know, some really great capability here.
We've really taken about 12 years of development and R&D into our legacy system and really just repackaged and repurposed it into this smaller business. So it is a quite a powerful tool that you're getting for, like you said, it's highly affordable for small businesses. And then we're looking to try to, like, really capture that piece of the market.
Has this got any application in the broader broader government sense, since we happen to have a mayor with us today?
We actually do work with our existing package. I would say about 75-80% of our businesses is city municipalities, K-12 schools, county libraries. That was really our initial foothold back in 2000-2001, we were setting up our initial business at a college. It was straight out of in the basement college business. Was me and my co-founder John Vickers. We started a network integration IT consulting company, and we were taking government funding, E-rate dollars, and setting up school districts up on and county libraries and municipalities up on the internet. And so the progression, we got out of the hardware because we were a boutique and the margins were tight and it was extremely competitive and brutal. And we're like, well, we need a recurring business model. And so we went to the software side of it. And so we understood that business. And so we just continued to grow in that government space.
And where are you located? You're here in the Alpharetta-Roswell area, right?
We're actually located in downtown.
Downtown.
We're in Midtown.
Midtown.
Down in 17th and Peachtree.
No, you're right in the heart of things.
Yeah, we're mixing it up. Now it seems like the heart of things is shifting maybe north. You see a lot more technology development up here in the north end. I think it's just a little bit more.
It's called Alpharetta.
It is Alpharetta. And we've seen we've actually been courted by quite a few people to move our operations out there. It's affordable. You get a little bit more space.
Well, expect a hard sell after this show. If people want to get in touch with you, see your website, try this on in their business, what should they do?
You can go to www.sherpadesk.com. Start exploring the site. And then from there, we call it the self-setup, self-service, and self-support model. So you can literally go in there with a few bits of information, and you already get access to the full-blown application, like I said, on a freemium model. So it's limited, but it allows you to explore the application.
And to get in contact with you?
You can send us, we have, so we do a little bit of branding. So you can contact us at yeti@sherpadesk.com. And that's a support contact to our support team. But my personal email address is patrick@sherpadesk.com. And we also have our phone number listed on the website.
Okay. I thank you for being on the show today. I encourage all those small businesses and large businesses to try this product on. It's a neat little product, and you can try it for free. That's a pretty powerful inducement. And I did have one question I forgot to ask. Does this integrate with Salesforce?
Actually, we're just now opening up the API. So the first launch is we just integrated into the Google Marketplace. So now your Gmail and Gmail gadgets are integrated. The phase two is we're just wrapping up is we're integrating into accounting packages. So basically, we're taking our time and billing and integrating into FreshBooks and Harvest and QuickBooks. And then the third aspect will be CRM packages.
Well, I'm glad we got that covered, because a lot of people will want to have this integrated heavily in their business, and it sounds like you're well on your way.
Yes, that's our next goal this year.
Okay, well, can you remain in the studio for our next set of guests?
Yes.
Well, super. You know, we wouldn't want you to escape, you know, the sales pitch for bringing your business to Alpharetta. let me welcome David Bell Isle, John Hypes, and Karen Cation with Hypes and Bell Isle. They are a business law firm in Alpharetta. David is the mayor of Alpharetta, and you come with great credentials and certainly a lot of erudition that one doesn't typically see on the letterhead of a law firm, where you've got people that have graduated at the top of their class and both law school and undergraduate. So welcome, David. Glad to have you with us today. First of all, you're the mayor of Alpharetta. Let's cover Alpharetta, and we'll get that off the table. There's a city of Milton. Johns Creek has gone crazy. We've had the mayor of Johns Creek on. Great guy. And it sounds like the cities are the movers and the shakers in Atlanta.
Yeah, Alpharetta, and Chris, thanks for having us on. Alpharetta is a unique city. We have a lot of new cities up here. Alpharetta is 155 years old, so we're kind of the older seasoned brother, if you will. But at the same time, we've got a lot of newness, a lot of things happening in Alpharetta. The two primary thrusts, which actually do work together, are our downtown efforts. Right now, we are in the process of implementing a $30 million bond, redoing downtown Alpharetta. And then there'll be a private part that comes on with that as well, to get shops, restaurants, retail. Avalon, of course, is coming, which is that big right now dirt pit off Old Milton Parkway and 400. But it's a $600 million project, so it's a significant investment into our city. We alluded to a moment ago during Patrick's conversation that technology is coming to Alpharetta. We actually have 600 technology companies inside the city limits of Alpharetta, another 300 around us, what I call Greater Alpharetta. So we've got a lot of just good companies, a lot of good vibe here. We have the same number of companies as Austin, Texas.
Is that right?
We don't yet have the same reputation as them, and so we launched last year the state's first technology commission with the governor's help, and we're in the process of just yoking the knowledge base and the strength and the companies that are here to do several things, to brand the city, to get a good infrastructure plan in place. We're looking at creating opportunities for technology startup companies. There's a lot going on in Alpharetta. We were ranked the seventh friendliest city by Forbes magazine last year, in part because of our downtown efforts, because of our business efforts. So even though we're 155 years old, we're still acting very spry and very young and really leading in terms of economic development, really, for the state of Georgia.
Well, I would never have guessed you're 155 years old. You don't look a day over 45.
I'm actually a lot younger than that, but we'll go with it. Don't age me.
Everybody looks young to me. So, your area of practice is in basically real estate finance and packaging the loans as well as turning those into securitized investment instruments, I understand.
That's right. I do mostly commercial closing, so mm-hmm. a lot like your residential closing, but we represent banks for your normal businesses, whether they're mm-hmm. office, retail, warehouse, that sort of thing, do a lot of medical office, that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And so most of the time we're representing the bank. Oftentimes we'll represent an investor or we'll represent a landlord and a landlord-tenant type situation. But my practice area is pretty narrow, and that's by design, and we have a good time doing it.
So what advice would you give someone who is going to lease a commercial property or thinking about buying one?
I think the biggest thing that we run into is that people sometimes you've heard Benjamin Franklin's a penny wise but a pound foolish. A lot of times people think, well, the other side has an attorney, so some legal mind is looking over the documentation, whether it be a lease or some other document, and I'll be fine. I'm pretty savvy, and so we'll be good. And in general respects, most people who have a business are savvy. They're savvy, though, in a business sense, not in a legal sense. And so when you start looking over these documents, if I'm representing a landlord, for instance, I am not doing what I'm supposed to do if I draft a neutral document. The entire, you represent someone to the best of your ability. You have a fiduciary obligation as an attorney to do so. So that document, without the balance of an attorney on the other side, is going to be one-sided unless your client tells you not to.
Ouch. It's like a real estate broker. I mean, they represent the seller. It looks like this thing is an even-handed transaction, but in fact, you really need your own realtor to advise you.
That's right.
Since the seller, buyer's broker.
Right.
Yeah, same kind of thing with commercial real estate. Do you get involved with franchise work at all?
Well, only tangentially. If we'll do, like we've done closings for Zaxby's owners and those type of things where you get a franchise. But again, in most of those situations, I'm representing that bank. And, of course, we have to review the franchise agreement and how it coordinates with what the lender's interests and needs are. That's kind of tangentially we do. And like I said, usually they're the other party when we're involved.
Now, what mistakes are what mistakes have you seen building owners make, as well as was some of the banks? Where have they started to go off course that frankly you saved them?
Well, fortunately, when the banks are with us, we do prevent a lot of things. The loan is only as good as the collateral, and so oftentimes through title searches, sometimes through the way things are set up legally, we just have to advise this just isn't a good loan for you. One of the most common situations we're seeing right now is a business condominium association where you've got a developer who came in and built some really nice looking, from all outward appearances, business condos, whether they're in one building or multiple buildings, and it looks like it's a sound development. But halfway through, they bailed out, and somebody, either the bank had to come in and foreclose, and now they're the owner, or someone came and got it. But the documentation on business condominium association, it has to be very precise in order for it to work, in order for it to be a valuable piece of collateral. And if it's not done right, there's a lot of corrective work that needs to be done, and you know, you can have situations where you end up in a litigation situation. You've got multiple owners with multiple interests, and no one ever set aside the common area. No one ever set aside, put up the corporation that acts as the property owners association. So there's a lot of things that can happen that way, and we do. We stand between our clients and making sure that what they think is good collateral actually is good collateral.
Yeah, it isn't flawed in some way, so that if something does go sideways, you know, you've got not only a mess, but a quagmire.
That's right.
Yeah. So obviously a very specialized area where you really need somebody that's an expert in this area of law, and that's clearly you.
Well, sure.
I love modesty.
We're not going to deny that.
Yeah, clearly a absolute expert in the area. So if I could move on now, I'd like to move to you, John. Welcome to our show. Now you're one of the magna cum laude from Georgia State College of Law. I mean, you know, that means you're pretty smart. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that means I put in a lot of late nights in law school. I don't know about the smartest part.
Yeah. And you've been at this for 25 years?
25, going on 26 years.
Wow. And it started with Smith, Gambrell, and Russell, I see, which is a very well-known name in Atlanta.
Yeah, early in my career, I was very fortunate to work with a couple of very excellent law firms, first with Smith, Gambrell, and Russell in downtown Atlanta, then later on at Morris Manning. And it was a great experience, great, great training ground, worked with some excellent lawyers, got exposed to a lot of different issues and ways to approach problems. So it was a great experience.
So, you've kind of become the commercial litigator in the firm, I gather.
The area within the firm, we have areas of emphasis and expertise. I use that term loosely. We're not holding ourselves out as quote-unquote experts, but we're good at what we do in specialized areas, and my area is the litigation area. I admire Karen and David because they practice what I would consider to be happy law. People come in and they leave smiling. In my area of practice, there's somebody who prevails and somebody who doesn't for the most part, and that's my chosen area.
So I noticed that some of the notes you gave me said that you deal with insurance coverage, interpretation, construction, real estate, employment, partnership, and shareholder disputes, tort and injury law. If you could pick a few highlights of where you've had to litigate things, and I'd like maybe your perspective on how did they get to the point of litigation.
Well, yeah, as an overview, business litigation, all businesses have to deal with contracts and agreements. And contracts could be oral contracts, but generally they're written contracts. And business litigation is nothing more than disagreements over agreements. And it can be employment with employment contracts and rights or insurance, et cetera. And in the area of business litigation, a lot of times disputes arise not so much to win or lose, but as just an additional tool to a business person to get a desired outcome. And it can be if I know, for example, in a shareholder dispute, that somebody is entitled to X amount of money upon selling their interest to someone else, and the other person reneges and decides that they're not going to pay that, it's not so much to win or lose. It's to renegotiate the original agreement. And once you understand that, once the client understands that, you at least approach it from the right perspective. Oftentimes, especially the larger business litigation cases, do not end up in front of a jury trial, but rather work themselves through the process so that both sides can live with the result that they settle. You know, what's been going on in recent years, you know, construction law was very prevalent up until about 08, and then starting in 09, 2010, you really didn't see many construction cases because there wasn't a lot of disputes going on, not a lot of agreements being made. Employment law, however, has...
Not a lot of construction going on.
employment law cases did increase significantly. There's been some changes in the law in Georgia that affect employment law issues. Insurance coverage issues have been on the increase. Insurance companies have become increasingly aggressive in terms of scrutinizing claims and whether or not certain claims will be paid. And with the environment of businesses downsizing and now back on the upswing, a good part of the practice also involves shareholder partnership disputes and the owners working through issues there.
What kind of issues do you see the partners run into that cause something to get so far as shareholder litigation?
Well, one of the topics coming into the radio show today was how to avoid costly mistakes. And clearly, if you have well-drafted corporate documents, such as an operating agreement or a shareholder agreement, you've pretty much decided in advance how you're going to handle certain issues when it comes time to buy someone out. If one of the owners passes away, what happens to that owner's interest? Even once you have the agreement in place, that's, again, as I said earlier, it's not to say that somebody won't try to use the agreement against the other person to renegotiate the deal and get a better outcome. But the biggest problem, I think, for any company is to be operating without an agreement. You know, Patrick over here says he has a co-owner partner. And I would presume, but don't know, that you all have an agreement between yourselves. But if not, you can. It's sort of shareholder litigation is a business divorce. Your shareholder agreement is a must prenuptial. And that's about the best way I can put it, because it just tells everybody what's going to happen as you proceed forward.
So. Interesting. What have you seen in terms of employment law? Have there been changes in terms of how that has, you know, played itself out with all the recession and people being let go and things like that?
Well, Georgia is an at-will state, and it's one of the most at-will employment states in the country.
And what exactly does that mean?
That means, in a nutshell, an employer can terminate an employee for any non-discriminatory reason. An employer could wake up in the morning and say, I got up on the right side of the bed instead of the left side of the bed. You're being terminated. But that termination cannot be the result of something that's discriminatory or has a on age, race, gender, things of that nature. Can't be based upon that. The biggest change, and it's sort of a seismic change in my opinion in Georgia, was when the state legislature redrafted the statutes on non-compete and non-solicitation. And it was such a big deal to me because we are an at-will state. The prior to the enactment of the statute, non-compete agreements were very hard to enforce. They were scrutinized very closely. If there were any drafting errors, they would be thrown out entirely. And that meant you could be fired for any reason, but once you were fired, you had the broader ability to go work elsewhere and not be prevented from pursuing your livelihood. Now, with the passage of the statute, non-compete agreements, non-solicitation agreements are much more easily enforced. The courts can be much more proactive. So the situation still exists. You can be fired for any non-discriminatory reason at any time, but when you sign one of these agreements with an employer, you may be out of the workforce for 1 or 2 years, and you know, you like your laws to protect you as a shield. You don't necessarily want your laws to be used as a sword to advance competition, but that's the nature of what Georgia has done to make it a more employer-friendly, competitive state, and that's what we have.
So that was really a big change. Has that resulted in less, you know, less in cases that have shown up in the courts or more?
Well, initially it caused more because the statute was being fleshed out in court. But I think it still remains to be seen. The statute became in effect in May of 2011, so we're relatively early under the new statute. And I think it's still being played out in court a little bit and how it will affect employee rights and competition within the state, I think it still remains to be seen. You know, we advise our employers that we represent that if they have valuable resources and information, you know, Patrick, you may have a sales force, for example, and you may have entrusted people that you've brought on with sales information that's not known to the public, and that's valuable to you. And we might say to you, you might want to have a new non-compete, non-solicitation signed in order to protect yourself. Now, if we represented the employee, we might say to the employee, you make sure before you sign that you're being compensated all that you want because you might be or that you need because you may be out of the workforce for a couple of years if Patrick wakes up one day and says your services are no longer required. So that's it's that type of scenario.
Or if it's a downturn.
That for any non-discriminatory reason.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Yes, I mean, you know, it may not be through any fault or even, you know, which side of the bed you got up on. It might be economic.
And our job as a business law firm is to advise our clients accordingly. So we, if our client is the employer, we have one set of advice. And if our client is the employee, we might have different advice.
Yeah. So the one message that comes out of this is there are a lot of ways to get yourself in trouble.
There are. You know, it's interesting in my line of work, you know, commerce goes on every day. It's going on as we speak, and 99-plus percent goes on smoothly with no hiccups. And I only see the ones where there are problems. And so I try not to be jaded, and I try to be positive by the fact that everything works smoothly. But, again, in business litigation, people come to our office to seek advice because they either anticipate a problem or a problem exists. But people stay out of trouble for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, the more proactive you are about what you put in place to start with, the less likelihood you are to have misunderstandings, disagreements, or something where there's not a clear way already to find out.
Absolutely. So, the ounce of prevention up front can keep people from coming to have to see me. That is correct.
Well, John, that's great advice for anybody in business. And now that we're on the subject of prevention, let's go to you, Karen.
Okay.
Because you're the chief preventer here.
Yeah, that's really how I regard my job, risk management and litigation prevention.
You know, the place to resolve things is before they happen.
That's right.
What do you see in your area of practice where people come to you with problems that, you know, you solve? What are your major things that you solve in your practice?
Well, typically clients will come to me either when they're getting ready to start up a business and they're thinking through their business plan and realize they should really have a lawyer check this out, make sure they've chosen the right corporate form or get some contracts drafted up, get their business contracts drafted up or reviewed on the front end. And, of course, a lot of times clients will come later on after they've been using a contract that maybe they drafted themselves or downloaded from the internet and have been using for a couple of years and said, hey, you know, we probably need to get this checked out. And they come to me and, you know, hopefully long before they've gotten litigation over it. And at that point, I view my job as risk management more than anything, and I take a look at what they have, or we start from scratch, talk about what their goals are and what they're trying to accomplish, and try and draft up a contract that's going to reduce the risk of litigation exposure.
So that's a pretty big job because, you know, you're dealing with a lot of internet-based firms and people that are doing business all over literally the world.
Right. And actually, the technology companies, I have a real passion for that since I was in-house at several technology companies for a number of years. And that kind of work is a lot of fun. And very often times, because technology companies either are starting out on a limited budget or because their business takes off so quickly, they haven't really had a chance to focus on the legal side of things. So I enjoy coming in and really assisting them and protecting them from the legal side of things so they can focus on what they do best, which is growing their business and selling their products.
Yeah. What What would you tell a business owner would be sort of the foundational documents they should have when they start their business and it begins to grow?
Well, first of all, they really want to consult with an attorney to find out, really get advice on what kind of business form is the right kind of form for their company, whether that's going to be a partnership, is it going to be a C corporation, LLC, what's going to work best for them, because it's very critical to establish that legal entity that's going to provide the business owner with protection from being held personally liable for the business's debts and liabilities. So that's really critical to consider what kind of form is the best one for your business. And also from a tax side, they should also consider talking with an accountant about, you know, the tax consequences of the different corporate forms and what makes the most sense for their business model. But that's the first critical step. And as John said, either an operating agreement or a shareholder agreement, depending on what corporate form you choose. And from there, you know, you don't want to make the mistake of you know, throwing together a contract or downloading one from the internet or you know, using one that you've had for 10 years in a back file and trying to customize it for your business. Not a good idea. It might get you by for a couple of years, but unfortunately, sooner or later, you're going to spend a lot of money on the back end trying to defend a litigation that arises because there's a business dispute and the contract wasn't clearly enough drafted to address that contingency.
Yeah. So those $35, you know, all the, you know, 500 contracts you can use in your business deals on the internet are maybe not such a good deal after all.
No, definitely not something I would recommend. It's better to put the investment, it's a pretty small investment, but make it up front, get the contracts properly drafted, and you can focus on your business and sleep well at night knowing that, you know, your company has had a professional take a look at the contract or draft the contract for you and protect your company as best they can from liability.
And there are a lot of places, I mean, from employment law and the things that go on in a company, you know, harassment. I mean, there are all sorts of things, you know, that you have to cover.
There are. That's right. And it's really different for every client, depending on what kind of business they're in and what their goals are.
It's a little bit like going to a doctor for a checkup and said, you know, like, here's my corporate body. Take a look at it and tell me what, you know, what I need to fix.
That's right. But I view it somewhat as putting together a puzzle. Drafting a business contract to me is putting together pieces of a puzzle to form a whole that's going to be the best possible protection for my client.
Well, we had a number of good questions, and I'm not sure who to direct them to, but some commentary on about five or six big issues that seem to have a recurring theme, and I'd like everybody to hop in on this one. First, is failing to form a corporation to protect yourself from personal liability.
Right. Well, that was what I was just talking about. Yeah. One of the first and primary considerations that any prospective business owner should make is decide what kind of corporate form is going to be the best form to protect you and your business interests, and of course, take into account the tax consequences as well.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not going to protect me from committing fraud and, you know, give me a get out of jail free card.
No, definitely not.
Well, you know, darn, there goes that, you know, investment, you know, scheme I had. So, you know, next thing is insurance coverage to cover claims. You know, how essential is that?
I can speak for a moment on a particular area of insurance, and that is title insurance on the real estate side. Occasionally, insurance is like, you know, whether it's claims insurance or title insurance. It's one of those things you don't need till you do. And sometimes people ask us, because, you know, the lender always is going to require that title be insured for their sake, for them being the insured. Of course, their insurance doesn't come into effect until the borrower is defaulted and no longer has an interest. So it's protect them when all else fails. So the owner's policy is always an option for them. And occasionally we get someone who feels they're very bright and thinks, well, you know, the odds are. And I tell people, look, you know, if you owned your house free and clear, you wouldn't have to have a homeowner's insurance policy, but you know, it's still a good idea. And, you know, it's funny, the things that they're from a very practical standpoint on an owner's policy situation, when somebody has one, we can save money when they come back, and most commercial loans are between 1 and 5 years in duration, so they have to come back at some point very soon. You know, we can save them money on the due diligence period and on the title exam if they have one. But also, more importantly, when there is something that a claim, or whether it's a tax issue, whether it's a loan that wasn't actually released, when something's in that chain, either regarding access or easements, you know, those are things that if that policy is there, there's no worries. But when that policy is not there, there can be some severe ramifications. And just because a lender is covered, that doesn't mean you are. And, in fact, you're not covered unless you got your own owner's policy.
John, you look like you have a comment on that.
Well, what I advise people when they're starting a business or growing a business, that there's three essentials, and that is they should have a good and trusted accountant, they should have a good and trusted attorney, and they should have a good and trusted insurance broker or agent. Your type of entity and your insurance coverage are going to protect you from liability as an owner. So if you set up a corporation or an LLC and then have insurance, you are protecting your personal assets in the event some claim is made. And, of course, you want to have your insurance coverage adjusted to the type of business that you have. If you have people handling money, you might want Fidelity insurance in case of loss of money internally. If you have directors and officers, you might want what's called D&O insurance, et cetera. But in any event, if you own real property, you want property and casualty insurance. And then related to that is on the accountant and entity side is you want to take home as much money as you can. So you want to have the proper entity and a good accountant in place so that your tax burden is as low as possible so that you can take the money home. So with those three professionals in place giving you advice and making sure that you have proper insurance, you can sleep better at night and hopefully make the most money possible while focusing on your work.
Our third question we had was, what do you see in terms of internal controls, oversight, and other risk prevention measures that businesses should be doing, but we end up maybe come into your office absent those things or that cause litigation?
Well, one of the things that I've always recommended to my clients is you need to have some processes in place up front. We talked about drafting the contracts, but you need to have a process where all your contracts that the business people are dealing with are going to come through and either get drafted or approved by your legal department so that nothing's going out the door, nothing's getting signed, money's not exchanging hands without your legal people having taken a look at these contracts and approved them first. And when you don't, things can unfortunately go terribly wrong. The same thing goes for deals. I always counsel my clients, it doesn't matter what size the deal is, always have a lawyer take a look at it. I've got an anecdote for you from one of my experiences with a client whose business team, acquisitions team, was traveling around the country acquiring subscriber bases, customer bases, from various smaller companies that were going out of business. And these were small deals, $100,000, $150,000 deals. The acquisitions team had been doing them on their own and never went through the company's legal department to have any of this approved, and things had been going okay doing that for a while. Well, unfortunately, it caught up with them on what was a $100,000 deal when it turned out that the subscriber base they purchased, they saw that a bank had a $4 million lien on that subscriber base, and the business people on the acquisitions team asked the bank, knew to go ask the bank and say, hey, we need you to release this lien. But they didn't know that they needed to insist on getting a document, a file stamp recorded document that showed that the bank had released the lien. So they didn't, and they paid $100,000 for the subscriber base from this other company. And when that company defaulted on its bank loan, the bank came after my client and said, okay, well, you know what? You owe me $4 million. And, it was just really a disaster on what should have been a $100,000 deal to, find themselves in litigation in court and ultimately, unfortunately, held liable in the seven figures for a bank lien, all of which could have been avoided if their business team had gone through the legal team first and said, hey, we need your approval on this deal before we move forward, because legal would have tagged that lien and said, no, we've got to have this document, the satisfaction of lien document in place before you can do this deal or the deal's off.
Well, I mean, you're taking somebody's verbal assurance that we're going to release that $4 million lien was a real mistake.
Absolutely.
It was a very expensive mistake. If they'd been talking to you, it
would have
never happened.
No.
They'd never snuck that one by.
Right. So the moral of that story is it doesn't matter how small the deal is. Get it checked out by your in-house or outside legal counsel before you move forward.
Wow, that was a big one. If I could ask another one, Give the people that are listening to the show some input on the importance of employment policies and training of employees in regard to those policies.
Well, when it comes to employment policy, you want to have policies in place and you want to apply them consistently. And when you think about starting up a company, it can be everything from, when you arrive at work, what the dress code may or may not be, what the vacation policy is, what your benefits policies are, whether or not you're going to have a 401k matching type policy, whether you're going to have health benefits. And, of course, health benefits are so much in flux right now with what's going on with federal law. But nevertheless, as an employer, you want to anticipate these things and be in front of the issues before you have to respond to an issue. And sometimes we see companies that start up, and that can end up on the back burner sometimes, or companies who started small and all of a sudden, they've done well for themselves very quickly and they're in a rapid growth mode. And they're hiring and taking on lots of employees, but they don't have certain policies in place. And if you have policies in place and can apply them consistently, once again, you will alleviate potential problems. If you apply what otherwise would be policies on an ad hoc basis, you might be creating problems for yourself down the road. So, for example, in our firm, we have several attorneys who practice in the employment law arena, one whose practice is devoted, Lane Kamsler, primarily to employment practice, and we regularly advise employers on putting together those policies so that they have those in place.
All right. You don't want to make them up as you go along.
No, you shouldn't make them up as you go along. That's a recipe for future problems.
Yeah, for needing to see John, I can tell later down the road. How about document retention? And do I have this right? Spoliation?
Yes.
Boy, that's a mouthful. That's a new one on me. What is spoliation?
Spoliation is the destruction of evidence relevant to a pending lawsuit. Not necessarily intentional destruction either. That case I told you about a few moments ago, there was a spoliation issue in that case because all the employees of that particular company did all their work on company-issued laptops that weren't required to be backed up to a centralized network or server. As a result of somebody's laptop crash, they would lose all their information and documents that they needed. Well, when the case went to litigation over this bank lien, a number of employees were called for depositions to give some testimony under oath. And one after another, we kept hearing, the bank would ask for documents, and the employee would say, well, I had those documents, but my laptop crashed 4 months ago and I lost everything. Or, I had those documents on my laptop and my laptop was stolen out of the trunk of my car. Or just I was running out of memory space on my laptop and I deleted everything, 4 weeks ago. And what that led to was a finding and an instruction by the court on spoliation. And what that was the judge basically instructing the jury towards the end of the case that the jury should make a negative inference about the lack of documents and materials that my client had been able to produce, and that the jury should assume that the documents that were destroyed were harmful to my client's position. It's a devastating instruction to give any jury, and I'm quite confident that greatly contributed to the unfortunate result and the unfortunate jury verdict that was issued in that case. So, document retention policy up front. That specifies when you can destroy documents, when you need to keep them, and when litigation is filed, when you need to notify your employees immediately. Litigation's been filed on this issue. If you have any relevant documents, do not destroy the documents. When you get that process in place on the front end, you're going to be able to prevent disasters like findings and instructions of spoliation on the back end if you find yourself in litigation.
Well, the dog ate my homework excuse is not going to get you past the judge.
No, judge is not going to buy it.
Well, I want to weigh in on this, and for our listeners, I think this might be a practical takeaway. We're in a different era now, technology-wise. 10 years ago, certainly 15 years ago, people did not communicate by email to the extent they do now. That's the reason Patrick Clements has his business that he does with emails and what. But it used to be you would do a memo or you would do a letter and you would carefully think about what went in writing and how permanent that is. Now, today, Many, many folks are willing to put things in an email that they would never put into a letter. And when it comes to document retention, you may have a lot of emails that you think, well, I really didn't express myself very well there, but you cannot destroy that email, even though it may be harmful to you in a dispute or in litigation, because you have to think of it in terms of, if I hit the delete button on that email, it's the same thing as taking a piece of paper that was a letter and lighting a match to it. Now, everybody would say, well, if I light a match and burn that memo or burn that letter, I've just destroyed evidence. Well, the delete key is the match. You cannot destroy evidence when you know that you are in a dispute or about to be in one. That destruction of evidence is really the highfalutin term spoliation. And so the word has not fully circulated to all businesses, certainly smaller businesses that don't have counsel, that, oh, well, deleting this or that email is not a big deal. It is a big deal.
Yeah, be very careful of what you delete, especially if you're involved in litigation or know that you're very likely to be, is the message.
Right, and to take that a step further, be very careful about what you put in an email.
And that was part of what
really
I was...
That's really the smart part.
I was trying to get that out.
Yeah, would you want to see this on the front page of the newspaper, because it could end up there.
Hey, there is one criteria for a trial lawyer. If you don't want your mother to see it or a jury to see it, don't put it in the email.
Yeah,
spoliation is important in what Karen and John are doing. Spoliation in what I'm doing most often is when the creamer is left out on the conference table too long.
That's why I drink coffee black now. I had spoliations floating in my coffee. And a final one to comment on, if you would, the necessity of protecting confidential information. And what do you do to protect your confidential information and trade secrets?
Well, I'll say from a closing perspective, you know, we're privy to a lot of private information. We're going to see, documents on that particular business, documents on those people, because we do searches not only on title, we do searches on individuals who are going to be guarantors, and so it is very important. We make, very special efforts to make sure what needs to be stored is stored and what is discarded is shredded. That concept reaches every corner of the law, but it's certainly in our practice, it's really about protecting not only the privacy of our clients, but our clients' clients, which are the borrowers and sellers in our transaction.
And part of confidential information, by its definition, is information that you take measures to keep confidential and that is not generally known to the public. So if you have sensitive information, Patrick across the table from here, if he has certain proprietary information in the development of his software that he wants to keep private, he needs to take measures to keep it that way. He needs to give password access only on an as-needed basis as opposed to wide-open computers, for example. And I'm just throwing this out as an example. Patrick's like, I don't do that.
No, actually, it's a two-pronged effect as far as, like, when we maintain confidentiality. It's policy and procedures as far as, like, who gets access to what level of service, as well as the technology that supports it. Are we running under SSL? Is our data housed in a SAS 70 location? So there's technology that helps prevent breaches in confidentiality, as well as our policies and procedures and who gets access to information.
And see, that's where a technical person can assist a business owner in taking those measures to keep information confidential. And then if you take those measures, you're protected under statute by the Georgia Trade Secrets Act. And you can take that a step further by entering into, with your employees and co-owners, if necessary, confidentiality agreements that will define the scope and breadth of what information will be kept confidential in the event that person goes to work elsewhere.
And Chris, I would add to that, especially with technology companies, you see on the startup end, when you're just starting a business and you're going to pitch to investors, angel investors, venture capitalists, whoever it might be, and you've got some proprietary software that you've developed, it's a very, very smart idea to get yourself a non-disclosure agreement on the front end before you go make those pitches and get that NDA signed, so that the people that you're pitching to can't say, hey, that's a really good idea. I'm gonna copy that and you know, launch a business with a similar idea to that. It's very risky when you're out there just closing your new company ideas, your company's proprietary software, making demonstrations of it. So you've got to protect yourself on the front end before you ever get that business launched by getting that NDA drafted up and putting it in front of the people you're going to disclose your company business plan and trade secrets to.
Seems like I remember reading quite a bit about that with Zuckerberg and Facebook.
There was a whole movie on the guy who created the intermittent windshield wiper. And it was a great movie.
Yeah.
He could have really benefited from a non-disclosure agreement.
Well, I know from my experience, NDAs are very, very difficult to get signed by a VC, especially like institutional capital. If you're talking to, I would definitely say like private investors, if you were going to go research angel, then NDA would probably be in your best interest. But you're going to be hard-pressed to try to get an NDA signed by a VC.
Yeah, the VCs aren't fond of those at all because they hear so many pitches from so many different companies.
Exactly.
They feel like they're going to be really hamstrung in who they can continue to hear pitches from if they've signed an NDA as to one company.
Now, there's so many crossovers that they could just be creating a quagmire themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's very clear from the things that we have heard today that there are a million ways to do it wrong. And not too many ways to do it right, but part of the solution for doing it right is having a very good law firm that represents you and that is more than one-dimensional, because you get the broad thinking of a group of well-experienced professionals to help you with every area of your business. And I can't think of one that I would pick any faster than I would Hypes and Bell Isle. So if one of you would be so good as to let our listeners know how to get in touch with you.
Absolutely. You can reach us, of course. Our phone number is easy, 770-664-6699. And, of course, we're on the web at hbilawfirm.com. And one last thing I just want to say, you mentioned the different practice areas. One of the great things about having a firm that has practice areas all centered around business is we have opportunities in which you get free collaboration, because sometimes things that we're working on touch other areas of law, and to be able to walk into another room and get free collaboration that doesn't show up on your bill, but there's insight there from other practice areas when they touch. And that's the beauty of having a full-service business law firm.
And I think that's one of the hidden values of having a really good law firm that's broad-based with lots of professionals that are well-experienced. You get these bonuses you don't pay for, which is a rarity in my experience with law firms. So enjoy. Everyone, thank you for being on the show today. If you know businesses that have a great story to tell, have a great product or service, we'd like them to get in touch with Business Radio X, and we'll get them on one of our shows.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.